I'm sorry also, this is the last part of the series, but probably everyone needs a bit of time off for Pesach and to listen to this amazing Pesach program that Julie sounds fabulous, which I'll have to try and catch some of that. And I'm going to cheat horribly because last week we were in about the 17th century, and I'm going to jump forward to the 19th and 20th centuries and even the 21st. So yes, I'm just fast forwarding here. And apologies for that. But I thought I'd like to end the whole series with a look at what's happening today in the relationships between Christians and Jews today, because they are very, very different indeed. So we're going to look at the sort of background to the modern situation. We're going to look at three major trends and events running from the late 18th century to the 19th century. Then in the second part, we'll look at what happened with different churches during World War II and the Holocaust, because that's a very important part of the story. And lastly, we're going to look at what happened after the war and up to today. So the first part, the sort of setup part, if you like, we're going to look at emancipation, nationalism and anti-Semitism, and migration. Those are particularly, they start in the late 18th century, but that's particularly characteristic of the 19th century. And these trends change the way that Jews live in Europe, and in fact, encourage many Jews to leave Europe. And it also alters the choices that Jews face about how to live as Jews. So we'll start with emancipation, which basically is the right to be considered a citizen. The Oxford Dictionary says it's the fact or process of being set free from legal, social or political restrictions or liberation. So this is the gradual incorporation of Jews as citizens in 19th century nation states, essentially. And it took a while. It was a direct result of the Enlightenment in the 18th century. And Enlightenment thinking, as you probably know, regarded human reason as the most important and significant value, and also introduced ideas such as liberty, equality, fraternity, progress for all human beings, and the separation of church and state. And political developments across Europe, sparked by the French Revolution in 1789, led slowly to the political emancipation of Jews in Western European countries, including rather slowly, but they did get to Germany, Austria, Hungary, France, Holland, and Britain. And it was a slow process, and it was not the same right across Europe, and there were some backward steps. If we just look at this list here, it sort of gets kicked off by the Edict of Tolerance, issued by Joseph II, who was the Emperor of Hungary. And looked at today, it doesn't look like a very advanced document, but it did recognize that Jews had certain rights. It said all sorts of things about them having access to education, including secular non-Jewish education, and also began the process of incorporating them into the state. Now, some of this is good and some of this is not good for the Jews. And some of it depends on your viewpoint, because up to this point, Jews are living as a nation within a nation. They have their own internal law courts. They have their own tax system. They also have to pay taxes more widely, but they can generate their own taxes, and that's used for community institutions. And often they had different languages from the people around them, their own completely closed education system. And they ran their communities very much the way they wanted, with a little bit of interference from outside. On the other hand, they didn't have, for instance, a citizen's right to reside in the country where they lived and were particularly vulnerable to be thrown at them. So emancipation means that they do gain rights like that. They gain rights of residence, they gain rights of education. But it's not an unalloyed granting of rights. It's also sometimes the taking away of Jewish privileges. So, for instance, the Edict of Tolerance was very hot on Hebrew and Yiddish being banned for business contracts, because that meant that people from the outside couldn't read the business contract, might not know what it contained. So something that was convenient for Jews and helpful for Jews gets taken away in the interests of making Jews part of the wider economy. On the other hand, they get security of residence in certain areas, which is definitely a plus. So this is a huge change for Jews. Their communities were, as we say, fairly closed. They had lived in very traditional ways. Tradition was never unchanging. It did move, but it changed slowly. authority was seen by Jews as embedded in sacred texts and the rabbis who interpreted them, though actually the position of the rabbis weakened throughout the 16th and 17th centuries, and they were increasingly defied by lay leaders of the community. So wealthy members of the community would put the rabbi in their place if they thought they were getting too far. But in traditional institutions, change happens slowly and people aren't always aware. Once Jews become citizens, and for instance, in France, as you can see, in 1790, they made a decree recognizing the Sephardi Jews of France as citizens. No, just the Sephardi. The next year, they decided they'd extend it to all the Jews of France. That was greatly contested at the time, but that meant that they would be much more integrated and expected to take on the duties of citizens, for instance, serving in the army. So rights and duties, privileges and obligations are a twinned set. You don't get one without the other. So once you became citizens, you might have to relinquish your own legal system. You might be incorporated into that. You might have the right of access to general education. Of course, it is still very Christian general education. You do have now the right of access to the general court systems, but that means maybe you have to lose your own court systems. And the old semi-autonomous community system that was really a result of the medieval times begins to break down. And now Jews face the sort of challenges of, can they retain a Jewish identity while taking part in the majority culture around them? How could you be both Jewish and German, or Jewish and French? And could you be both at the same time? Or did you have to choose between those identities? And these questions were also asked by the Christians in the countries where Jews lived. Did they think the Jews were actually capable of this? And some of those questions are still very much with us. But this is the first time they really come up with practical consequences for Jews. And you can see slowly, slowly it trickled through. 1796, emancipation of Dutch Jews, then you get to Rome, emancipation of Prussian Jews. At this time, Germany is not a single country. It's broken up into various different ones. 1830, quite early, Greece grants citizenship to Jews. You notice, however, 1848, the parliament in Frankfurt emancipated the Jews, but then changed their mind the next year. And slowly, slowly, this process percolates. And you can see two types of change in the status of Jews. Reform and revolution. So reform is sort of from within the system. And we were talking about Joseph II's Edict of Tolerance. So, for instance, some restrictions are removed. Christians are allowed to send their children to Christian schools. Jews are allowed to send their children to Christian schools. They don't have to pay tax every time they move anymore. They don't have to wear recognizable Jewish dress. Some restrictions were renewed, however, or introduced. Jews still couldn't live in Vienna. Numbers of marriages of Jews were restricted, which was a major problem, you can imagine. And as we mentioned before, the use of Hebrew and Yiddish in business documents was banned. So sometimes that would, again, it would be a mixed bag. It's important to remember that it became a liberal aim among the non-Jews of these societies, not really for egalitarian or democratic principles. For many people in the non-Jewish world who supported these measures, it was a way of actually finishing off the Jews, of dragging them into the general society and civilizing them. And sometimes that meant converting them to Christianity. So it wasn't an unmixed bag. Even the privileges sometimes came with a bit of a price tag. The thinking was that you would stop Jews being these backward members who were holding back society, and you would make them progressive and you would integrate them. And that obviously involved changing their nature. Very few people at the time felt they could both integrate into general society and maintain their different identity. That wasn't really on the books at the beginning. And you still find that debate about immigrant groups in different countries today. So it's a two-edged process. You win some, you lose some. And constantly you're thinking, which of those sides do I want to go with, or how does that affect my particular identity? So that is a long, slow, difficult process. And it also varies enormously from different country to different country. In some ways quicker, but also more absolute, is the revolutionary process, which you see particularly in France, obviously, because they had a revolution. And because of the rationalist Enlightenment principles that were very much embodied by the French Revolution, it made it very difficult to justify keeping Jews as a special group outside general society. And the French Declaration of the Rights of Man in 1789 states all men, notice men, are born free and equal in rights, and no person shall be molested for his opinions, even such as are religious. It wasn't obvious that that applied to people who weren't French or Christian. Maybe that was just French or Christian men. And they had this year of debate, and finally, whether to admit Jews as citizens, and this is what they came up with. The National Assembly, considering that the conditions requisite to be French citizens and to become an active citizen are fixed by the Constitution, and that every man who, being duly qualified, takes the civic oath and engages to fulfill all the duties prescribed by the Constitution, has a right to all the advantages it ensures. So, in pursuit of that, the National Assembly annuls all adjournments, restrictions, and exceptions contained in the preceding decrees affecting individuals of the Jewish persuasion who shall take the civic oath, which shall be considered as a renunciation of all privileges in their favor. So here the bargain is very clear. You can sign up to be a citizen, but by signing up to be a citizen, you unsign to be a Jew with different privileges. And so, I mean, having your own legal citizen is quite a privilege, but if you signed the civic oath, that was it. You said, okay, I agree. I'm giving up my special Jewish privileges. So once this started to have an impact on the traditional Jewish world at the end of the 18th century, you can imagine everything changed. You know, everything is now up for grabs. Some Jews began to absorb and think about these contemporary ideals of rationalism and a secular and very mobile society and religious tolerance. And in the 1770s, Jewish intellectuals in Berlin, of whom the most famous was Moses Mendelssohn, of whom you've probably heard, began to disseminate their ideas on this process, and they sparked an international Jewish movement devoted to Enlightenment values and to reforming education, religion, and the economic basis of Jewish society. This is the famous Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment movement. So they didn't necessarily adopt everything, and they cast it in a Jewish mold, but they wanted to see a better society with more opportunity for everyone, and to do away with some of what they regarded as old-fashioned thinking that was holding people back very clearly. And the advocates of the Haskalah were known as the Maskilim. The early Maskilim were very frum indeed. It's only when you get to the end of the 19th century, you get more irreligious Maskilim. But really, the early Maskilim would have made all of us look extremely unfrum. So it wasn't an anti-religious movement, but certainly not at the beginning. Another development was the founding of Reform Judaism, which is another reaction to these new opportunities. And what became Reform Judaism, it wasn't defined as such at the beginning, was another attempt to navigate that tricky space between Jewish religious practice and European cultural expectations. And if you look at a lot of the very, very early Reform synagogues, they're very exercised by things like not letting people spit on the floor because it wasn't civilized, and decorum in services, and having the sermon in a language people could understand, none of which is particularly characteristic of Reform or particularly odd these days, but at the time was quite something. There were people who fought to the death to have sermons always in Yiddish and never in the language of the country, for instance. That was really one of the big arguing points at the beginning. So change outside the Jewish community led to change inside the Jewish community, and a sort of recalibration of Christian-Jewish religions relations as part of that. So this is element one in the mix. Element two is the rise of nationalism, and with it, sometimes, anti-Semitism. And I'll picture here the famous Dreyfus affair, which we'll talk about in a moment. So in the mid-19th century, there was a bit of a backlash against the Enlightenment, and that encouraged the rise of nationalism throughout Europe, often, but not always, but often accompanied by political and racial anti-Semitism, which was a new thing, especially in Germany and France. And racial theories, including the idea that white people are better than black people, became very common in the late 19th century. And the main idea of racial anti-Semitism, as presented by theorists like Joseph de Gobineau, was that Jews are a race and they are a distinct race, and that they are inferior compared to the European nations. Shelley, you've got a question. Do feel free to ask.
Yes, my question is, you have left out... despite all of the rights that they get by, in the early 19th century, there's a huge amount of conversion, especially in Germany. So why is that? Why did they feel they had to convert if they got rights and they could still be Jewish and they could go into the education system? It seems to me that a lot of them converted. They didn't convert because they liked Christianity. They converted because they thought there were opportunities for them. Yeah. Why weren't there?
Remember, I said Germany was a patchwork of very different mini states. So there were different rules in every area. In areas like Berlin, things didn't move very fast. So, for instance, only a certain number of Jews could live in Berlin. And if you weren't on the list, you couldn't live in Berlin. And things like that in some places took longer to change. So one of the reasons that Jews converted was you could short-circuit the whole process. Plus, as we said before, that tricky space of being both German and Jewish or French and Jewish was very challenging, still is very challenging being two identities like that. And for some people, they decided they would rather be one thing than the other. They thought things would be easier. They weren't getting all the possible rights. It was a difficult status to be part of one society and part of another society, and both those societies very, very new. For many people, it was worth saying, well, I'm moving completely to one society, and then I won't have these problems of being in the middle. I won't have to negotiate my identity. I don't have to wait till they do this right because I live in the wrong city and they haven't got round to this one yet. I can have it all now. And as Heinrich Heine himself, a convert, said, he talked about baptism as the passport to European civilization. And for many people, it was, because these rights came in slowly. Sometimes they were taken away again. It didn't affect everyone. And they still left you with an uneasy negotiation between two identities. And sometimes, for some people, conversion was the easiest path. Didn't always work out that way, because people tended not to forget that you were a convert. But some people certainly embarked on it thinking this was the way to get out of all their problems. They might have been wrong. And it was most prevalent in Germany, and I think to a certain degree France, but Germany in particular. And because Germany was such a varied society with varied rules, you'd probably have to look on quite a micro level and say, where was that person living? What were their personal difficulties? What were the things they couldn't get around? Or what were the opportunities that they were desperate for that was being denied them? Did they want to move to Berlin? And they simply couldn't. And it was still impossible. So it might be a lot has been written about those converts, and which I haven't read at all. But you could have a really good time looking at that, because things will have been investigated there. So if we go back to anti-Semitism and nationalism, these racial theories arise, and Jews are suddenly being defined as a race, not an idea before. The whole racial idea was a 19th century idea, not the way medieval people thought. They noticed skin color changes, but that didn't seem to them to mean that whole groups of people could be defined one way or another. Much more important what religion you were, and then you could definitely define whole groups one way or the other. So these 19th century theorists emphasized the non-European origin and culture of the Jews, and it claimed that even if they converted to Christianity, it would make no difference at all. As you can certainly see under Hitler, it didn't matter if you converted, you were still Jewish. And that was very different from the religious-based anti-Judaism in the Middle Ages, which, okay, you converted, you were a Christian. You might be a bit of an iffy Christian, you might have this shady past, but you were still a Christian. That was it. You weren't a Jew anymore. That didn't work for the racial theorists. You couldn't ever escape, biology was destiny. So this modern anti-Semitism emphasized hate of Jews as a race, not just because they had a different religion, but because of these rather weird racial ideas that were part of a wider system saying, whites are best and everybody else is inferior. And we can prove it scientifically. And they did a lot of head measuring and intellect measuring and this and other and which, and claimed baselessly that their results supported their ideas. Of course, applying the idea of race to Judaism is ridiculous, because given that Jews have a very varied ethnic makeup and there have been converts throughout the ages and still are, there is no scientific basis. The whole concept of race is not scientific, but there is no way, even under those rather warped concepts, that you could claim that Jews were a race, because they've demonstrably been marrying in and out and what have you for centuries and centuries. So it's mad, but that never stopped anyone yet. And one of the most famous examples of anti-Semitism in the 19th century was the Dreyfus Affair. In 1894, a French officer of Jewish origin, Alfred Dreyfus, who was completely, completely secular, by the way, not religious in any way, shape or form, was accused of selling military secrets to the Germans. And anti-Semitism played a huge part in this, with those who thought Dreyfus was guilty constantly going back to the fact that he was Jewish. France split into pro and anti-Dreyfus factions, and there were public demonstrations, there were riots. Dreyfus was condemned and sent to prison. But in 1896, new evidence came to light that showed that the real culprit of selling the military secrets was another officer, Ferdinand Esterhazy, who was not Jewish at all. The army hid the evidence and forged documents to add extra charges against Dreyfus. In 1906, the verdict was finally overturned and Dreyfus was freed. But the affair had split the country and it left very deep social divisions. The affair revealed the wide extent of anti-Semitic feeling in France, and it inspired the Austrian journalist Theodor Herzl, whom you may have heard, to found the Zionist movement in 1897. So you can see how intimately that's connected. And Herzl and many other Jews felt that they would always be hated in Europe, and they should try to found a new Jewish society in the ancient Jewish home in Palestine, which, of course, at the time was part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. There were openly anti-Semitic political parties in several European countries, such as the Anti-Semitic League in Germany. It was all out loud and proud. You didn't have to pretend. It was respectable. That was founded by Wilhelm Marr in 1879. And there was an Anti-Semitic League of France, founded by the journalist Edouard Drumont in 1889. And France was particularly prone to this organized and popular anti-Semitism. The French Revolution had already pushed the Catholic Church to the margins and given rights to the Jews. So there was a deep division in the country. And the Dreyfus affair sharpened this. People who were very attached to the Catholic Church tended to regard the Jews as having engineered this or to be responsible or having benefited from the marginalization of the Catholic Church. And they didn't like the Jews for that, even though they were wrong. Those who supported Dreyfus tended to be pro-Republic and opposed to the Catholic Church, and those who condemned Dreyfus tended to be pious Catholics who supported the army. So it was allied to a whole load of other social splits too. But that was a major thing, and not just in France. I've taken this as an example, but it is by no means the only example. And the third trend that we see setting up this whole situation is that of migration. And here's a wonderful photo of Jewish refugees from the Russian Empire arriving in England, I'm not sure where in England, in 1882. And I also think a lot of people I know, these are probably their great grandparents. They all look terribly miserable as well, they might. And this was, there was a lot of migration. First of all, there was a move from small and rural communities to much bigger urban concentrations of Jews. And there was a huge population explosion in the 19th century. And just looking at the Jewish part of it, the population of Jews in Europe went from 3 to 12 million in the course of the 19th century. And that's overall by 1910. Yeah. And over 80% of those were in Europe. In 1881, you have the assassination of the Tsar Alexander II in Russia, and that led to countrywide waves of violence against the Jews. Throughout the empire, there was one Jewish girl among the plotters who assassinated Alexander II. So, okay, there's one Jewish girl there. Jews got blamed for the whole thing. Over a million Jews emigrated as a result of these attacks, most to America and I imagine Canada as well. Some to the UK. There is a local urban legend that says a lot of people thought they were in New York when they got off the boat and only discovered years later they were in London. I'm really not sure if that's true at all, but it might be true. But there are also people who'd had enough seasickness and felt, I can't go another mile in a boat. I'm staying here. But I don't know about the people in this class, but I imagine many of you may have ancestors who left the Russian Empire at that time and moved westwards, because that's a very, very common story. Certainly in the UK, 3/4 of UK Jews have ancestors who came in the 1880s from Eastern Europe. A small number went to Palestine, which, of course, as we said, was part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire up till 1917, when it became a British mandate. Now, Jews had always moved around a lot, partly because they were expelled and partly because if you had relations in far-flung cities, it was really good for trade and you could have a wonderful merchant life nipping from one city to another where you found a Jewish community ready to house you and talk to you and you had various common languages and common culture. So it's not that Jews were staying put before, they were moving, but this size of migration was absolutely unprecedented, absolutely huge. And also they were moving to new places like America and Canada. And this continued into the early 20th century. It was really halted by World War I. One effect of the Holocaust, of course, was to change Jewish settlement in Europe. Before the Holocaust, there were about 9.5 million Jews in Europe, and 2/3 of them died in the Holocaust, and many others moved. So Europe suddenly had this huge fall in Jewish population, which, of course, has enormously impacted the Jewish history. So I'm going to assume everyone has a basic knowledge of the Holocaust, and we're not going to discuss it because this is a one-hour session. But we're going to move on to Christian-Jewish relations before and after the Holocaust. And when we come to look at the role of Christianity in the churches during the Holocaust, there are two main areas that need to be thought about. And the first is, what about the theological or ideological side of things? Did the teaching and doctrines of Christianity enable or even inspire the Nazis' idea to devise and carry out this plan of exterminating all Jews? And the second question is, what did the different churches in Europe actually do in the lead up to World War II and during it in relation to Jews and to the Nazi program to kill them? So it's a story of two parts. Okay, so we'll look at the theological and ideological themes first. Now, it's often been asserted that existing Christian doctrines that taught that Jews were hard-hearted or responsible for the death of Jesus or innately wicked created the sort of anti-Jewish atmosphere in which it was very easy for Nazis to persuade Christians to help in carrying out the murderous programs. And these claims see Christianity as bearing a very high degree of responsibility in creating that sort of environment in which such things could happen without any opposition. In contrast, you will find people who studied it claiming that in spite of such teachings, the Nazis' desire to wipe out all Jews was something completely new. It had not formed part of Christian teaching, and that Christianity as a whole cannot be blamed for the Holocaust, even if individual Christians did enthusiastically take part in the Nazis' actions. So we'll look at some of the Christian doctrines and teachings that have been the focus of attention in this, some of them we've mentioned earlier. So there is stuff in the New Testament that certainly can be interpreted in a very, very nasty way. And it seems a little inaccurate to class the whole of the New Testament as an anti-Jewish text, given the fact that it very clearly records that Jesus was Jewish, as were all his early disciples and followers. Paul, the author of many of the New Testament epistles, was also Jewish. The Gospel of John, which includes several texts condemning the Jews, is often understood today as reflecting arguments within a Jewish Christian context rather than speaking about all Jews. So there are various theories out there that the Jews in John is just the group of Jews we don't agree with rather than all Jews and we're not part of them. But there is no doubt that whatever the original authors of the New Testament text meant to write, several texts within the New Testament itself have been interpreted in very anti-Jewish ways. And here are some of the best or the worst, if you like it. So this one from Matthew is in the course of Matthew's account of the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. And he claims that all the people, implying all the Jews, shouted to Pilate, "Let Jesus be crucified. His blood be on us and on our children." And that led to Christian teaching that all Jews are Christ killers, which was definitely taught. One of the views later rejected by the Catholic Church in 1965, as we'll see later, but it was a common view throughout the Middle Ages and up to the 20th century and does survive in places today. Or you have the Gospel of John. Jesus said to them, the Jews listening to him, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I came from God and now I am here. I did not come on my own, but he sent me. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot accept my word. You are from your father, the devil." So again, this is an odd thing to put in the mouth of a Jewish Jesus, to tell other Jews that their father is the devil. A little odd, which again is one of the sources of the idea that maybe when the Jews are represented as a group in the Gospel of John, it's not all Jews, it's Jews who don't agree with Jesus' followers. But again, if you don't read it with that understanding, you can very easily read this as Jesus said that Jews are descended from the devil. And at the end of this extract, "The reason you do not hear them," the words of God, "is you are not from God." So if you take that quite literally, that's pretty nasty. Doesn't give a lot of wiggle room. And then if you move to one of the epistles, the first epistle to the Thessalonians by Paul, says, "For you, brothers and sisters, became imitators of the churches of God in Christ Jesus that are in Judea, for you suffered the same things from your own compatriots as they did from the Jews, who killed both the Lord Jesus and the prophets and drove us out." Now, given that Paul is a Jew, this is a funny thing to be writing. So again, it may be this restricted sense of Jews who don't agree with us, but you can certainly read it as a general way. And he ends up by saying, "Thus they have been constantly filling up the measure of their sins, but God's wrath has overtaken them at last." So again, all those texts, we could spend a long time analyzing those texts, but that sort of text served as fuel for anti-Jewish teachings and preachings. There are other texts that describe Jews as unable to understand their own scriptures, or that Jesus has initiated a new covenant between God and Jesus' followers, and that has nullified the earlier covenant between God and the Jewish people. That's supersessionist thinking. And whatever the original authors meant, there is absolutely no doubt at all that later Christians understood them in supersessionist and anti-Jewish ways. Maybe not all later Christians, certainly not many Christians, but some Christians now might still, but it would be unusual now, but certainly in the Middle Ages, yeah. So the ideas developed that Jesus had killed Jesus, they could have thus been said to have killed God, that they were demonic, that they were associated with the devil, that they were evil, that they hated everybody else, that they willfully refused or were too stupid to understand their own scriptures, and that God had taken back his covenant with them and made a new one with the Christians. So that's all good supersessionist thinking, and that was a basic belief in many Christian churches till quite recently. And for a comment by a Christian theologian on this, looking back, he sums this up. He says, Christians found confirmation for these interpretations within salient historical events. The destruction of the Second Temple, the defeat of Bar Kokhba, and the emergence of the triumphant church were heralded as irrefutable evidence in support of a displacement theology. It was more or less the same thing as supersessionist theology. The early Christians viewed every catastrophe that befell the Jewish community as just punishment for Jewish complicity in the murder of Jesus Christ. So that's a really good summation of the way it worked. However, that didn't necessarily equate to killing all the Jews. And we mentioned this before, in the early 5th century, the church father Augustine developed a doctrine that set a limit to the practical consequences of supersessionist thinking. And according to this, Jews must be protected from being eliminated so that they can provide the world with a sort of negative witness, giving evidence by their degraded state of what happens to people who won't accept Jesus. And here is a little quote from Augustine. The impious race, genus, and genus does not mean race in that 19th century sense. It's much more an ethnic or a sort of general term. It's not a pseudo-scientific racial term. Of the carnal Jews will never die a bodily death. In other words, they'll all be there. They're always going to be there. They're always going to be Jews. Whosoever would destroy them in this way will unloose a vengeance sevenfold. That is, he will bear away from them the sevenfold vengeance which I have wrapped around the Jewish people to protect them on account of their guilt in murdering Christ. Thus, the Jewish people will never perish for the whole length of the 7 days of time. This is a way of thinking that sees the whole of human existence divided in 7 days according to the creation account. They make visible to the Christian faithful the subjection that they merited, because they, in the pride of their kingdom, put the Lord to death. So Augustine is saying, no, you can't kill Jews. Jews have got to stick around because they're our best form of evidence that we are right and they're wrong. So classical Christian thinking didn't actually advocate the elimination of all Jews in the way the Nazis did. So it would be hard to say that the Nazis learnt that from the Christians. And some modern scholars like Mark Saperstein would argue that though these quotes and ideas were discriminatory and anti-Jewish and horrible, they can't be understood as directly leading to the horrors of the Holocaust. The Nazis based their ideas much more on the racial theories we were talking about, and they only co-opted Christian ideas that were useful to them, but they didn't take the Christian ideas as their starting point. They were just, oh yeah, there's another bit of fuel we can add to the fire. Others would argue that this teaching of contempt, as it's known for Jews, that characterized Christian culture provided a very fertile environment for Nazi ideas to flourish wherever they got them from, and helped to convince many Christian accomplices to help the Nazis to carry out the final solution, that they were acting in accordance with their faith. So there are arguments on both sides. So what happened in practice? We've talked about the theory. Okay, the Catholic Church doesn't have the best record, but generally speaking, the story of the churches in Nazi-occupied Europe is very much a story of two parts. While many of the upper hierarchy in the institutions of the major Christian churches, including the Pope, Pope Pius XII, did next to nothing to protect Jews, and some Christian leaders enthusiastically supported the Nazis, there were thousands of individual Christians, as well as some Christian churches, that not only denounced the Nazi oppression of the Jews, but actually put their own lives at risk and sometimes lost their lives by hiding Jews or smuggling them to safer countries. So some is good, some is bad. In the Netherlands, for instance, out of a total Jewish population of 140,000, 107,000 were killed. But local people, many of them really religious and committed Christians, personally saved about 25,000 Jews in the Netherlands. So at the risk of their own lives, if you were found harboring a Jew, you were killed. That's quite a lot. And again, you can see this story of two parts. So Catholic Church, mixed record. At the highest level, Pope Pius II consistently refused to issue a clear condemnation of Nazi persecution of the Jews, or even to forbid Catholics from taking part in it. But before he came Pope, he had engineered an agreement known as the Concordat between the Church and the Nazi government of Germany, which guaranteed the rights of the Catholic Church in Germany. And at the time, about a third of Germans were Catholics. And Article 16 of that Concordat stated all new bishops had to take an oath of loyalty to the leader of the state, and all clergy were required to abstain from working in and for political parties. So they all had to just toe the line politically. Many people at the time and later felt that gave a Catholic seal of approval to the Nazis. Others argued it protected many Catholics from suffering under the Nazi regime. And they also point to the fact that thousands of Jews were hidden in Catholic monasteries and convents throughout Europe, though it should also be remembered that very often after the war, those institutions refused to give those children back to surviving relatives and in many cases baptized them as Christians. In 2020, really recently, the Vatican released records from the time of Pius XII that show that he knew all about Auschwitz and the death camps by 1942, even though they denied later on, the Vatican denied any knowledge of these things when the Americans asked them. They said, oh, we never didn't know about that, but they did. And for instance, on October the 16th, 1943, more than 1,200 Jews were arrested by the Germans in the Jewish district of Rome, right at the edge of the Vatican. Within a week, more than 1,000 of them had been gassed at Auschwitz, and the Pope didn't say anything at all. In contrast to that lack of action at the highest levels, however, we can compare the Catholic bishops in the Netherlands. And in July 1942, they sent a letter protesting the treatment of Jews to the commander of the Nazi forces in the country, which was a pretty courageous thing to do. The letter was also read out in all Catholic churches in the Netherlands. And some have pointed out it might have done more harm than good, because the Nazis rounded up a whole load of Jewish converts to Catholicism and took them off to the death camps, and they'd been sparing them till then. So again, at the time, it wasn't absolutely all clear what was the best thing to do and whether you might not make things worse by speaking out. So people didn't know. What about the Protestants? So about two-thirds of the Germans were Protestants. They belonged to different churches. The largest, the German Evangelical Church, saw the emergence of a movement known as the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, and that embraced many Nazi ideas, nationalistic ideas, and racial ideas. And they wanted to create a Reichskirche, a national church with a Nazi version of Christianity. But there was an opposition, another movement called the Confessing Church, the Bekennende Kirche, which said its primary allegiance was to God and the scriptures and not to Hitler. And both movements were part of the German Evangelical Church. There were some neutrals who didn't want to get into the fight at all. The most famous members of the Confessing Church were the theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, that's him on the left, and Martin Niemöller. Bonhoeffer was executed for his role in a conspiracy to overthrow Hitler's regime. And Martin Niemöller spent 7 years in concentration camps for criticizing Hitler and his actions. Neither was really typical of the Confessing Church. Despite their examples, the arguments, it was very much an internal church matter rather than a fight against Nazism for a lot of the people involved, apart from these two particularly. And even in the Confessing Church, most leaders were really concerned with blocking state interference in church affairs. But there were members of the church clergy and the laity who did oppose and resist the regime, and some of them hid and helped Jews and helped them to escape. So the picture varied enormously from country to country and from church to church. In Czechoslovakia, for example, in spite of protests by individual bishops and priests, the Catholic authorities seem to have just acquiesced in the deportation of 60,000 Jews to the death camps in return for the 20,000 Jews who converted to Catholicism being spared. And often there were trade-offs like that. In Hungary, the Pope promoted an anti-Semitic priest post of bishop, but other Hungarian bishops and a nun who was a member of parliament, rather oddly, spoke out against the persecution of Jews in public. So it's a very complicated picture, and you can't make generalizations. You need to look at different countries, different churches, and see what those particular institutions in that particular environment did. But it is possible to say that enough Christians actively supported the Nazi attempt to exterminate the Jews for the post-war churches to be deeply troubled about the role they had played during the Shoah and the necessity of facing up to what they had either done or condoned or acquiesced in. So I'm going to pause there because I see we have a lot of questions. Let's have a little look in the chat. What have we got? We have got, that's very nice that today's learning is sponsored. I'll just read that out by Morris and Doreen Sosnovich to commemorate the 82nd yahrzeit of Morris's paternal grandmother, Mimichai Bakdovich, who was murdered in the Holocaust. So that's very, very appropriate for that session. Yeah. Okay. How bad was anti-Semitism in 1797? Well, yeah, as we were saying, yeah, depended who, but the certainly people who'd remained loyal to the Catholic Church had been sidelined by the revolution were pretty anti-Semitic. What sort of privileges did the Jews have in France in the 18th century? What were they giving up? Well, again, what we said before, they ran their own semi-autonomous affairs. They had their own legal system. They had their own tax system. They had their own, sometimes they had their own prisons. They had their own education system. They didn't have any state interference and all that. They could do what they wanted within their communities. So they did have privileges. There wasn't anybody else. Everybody knew Latin? No. Usually just clergy knew Latin. No, the 19th century. Why is nationalism seen as singular opposition to the Enlightenment? I don't know if it's singular. It was a reaction to the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was very much about liberty and universality and fraternity, and nationalism was very much about our lot are the best and everybody else's are definitely not as good as ours. So it was a reaction, you could say, to Enlightenment, to Enlightenment values. Still to this day, American Jew, Jewish American. Yes, it's an eternal question. Conversion was definitely a way to gain social acceptance. Absolutely. Scapegoating wasn't is an ongoing theme. Yes, all minorities really. Yeah. Don't know what the position of Muslims is in Canada, but a lot of scapegoating of Muslims in the UK, or you know, anyone you like. If there's a small group, you can all pile on top of it. Jews will do that too. That's human nature, not very nice. Can't be true, may take any Jews years to figure out they're on a different continent. That's why I think this is probably an urban legend, but I have been told by various people, oh, the reason my grandfather came to London was they told him it was New York. I honestly don't know if it's true. I've read that Hitler wanted to get rid of the Jews in Europe, not all over that because he lost the war. No, he wanted to kill all Jews, full stop. Did Jesus really say these things? Well, right back in the first session, we said we don't know what Jesus said because he didn't leave any writing. So it's all secondhand reports. And we honestly don't know what he said and what he didn't say and whether followers wrote down stuff that they thought he'd said or wanted him to have said. We just simply don't know. Charges of deicide nearly 2,000 years, not repented by the 965 Catholic change for then existing Jews, not for ancestral Jews. Well, we're going to look at those documents later on so you can make your mind up about that. Righteous Gentiles were infinitesimally small. Well, there were several, definitely I'd say tens of thousands of them, and not everyone who's defined officially by the State of Israel as a righteous Gentile. I mean, that doesn't cover everybody. There are other people who haven't been documented. They're still finding out people. There were, I sort of think, you know, if I'd been not Jewish in the middle of occupied Netherlands, would I have been brave enough, say my kids were small, would I have been brave enough to risk death by harboring a Jew? I don't know. I think it's very hard to blame people who didn't do that unless we ourselves have been in that position. We all know it's the right thing to do. Do we all do it? I venture to say, probably we don't. How many of us today are housing refugees? Don't know. Okay, so let's go back to that. It's very difficult. I just want to say, it is really easy to judge people in history. When it comes to us, it's difficult to know sometimes what we do. And sometimes what we do is not what we think we do. So, yeah, there are some people who can judge, absolutely, yeah. People who failed to be as active as we would have liked them to have been, it's, you know, I don't know if I would have been. I cannot say absolutely that I would have taken that moral stand. I hope I would have, but I don't know. So I'm reluctant to judge people. Okay, so in the aftermath of the Holocaust, it became pretty clear that the churches had a lot of thinking to do, and urgent questions arose for all of them. How was it possible for 6 million Jews to be murdered by the citizens of a nation that was predominantly Christian? How had churches elsewhere in Europe, outside the Nazi-occupied areas and in the United States, responded to the persecution and genocide? How far had traditional Christian doctrines and teachings, and the supersession as ones among them, enabled the Nazis to pursue their aims and enlist the help of Christians? Did Christians bear some degree of responsibility for what had happened? And if so, how could they make amends? And what could they do to prevent such things ever happening again? And after 1948, how did the foundation of the State of Israel affect traditional Christian understandings of the relationship between Christians and Jews. So things did start moving. They took a while, but things started moving. So in the 30s and 40s, you get scholars like James Park in England, Jules Isaac in France, who prepared the way for an admission of complicity, at least in the Holocaust, through their work on the long history of anti-Semitism in Christian culture. So Jules Isaac wrote a book called The Teaching of Contempt. This is where the phrase comes from, L'enseignement de mépris. That was published in 1962. And he was very influential in the formation of the 10 points of Seligsburg, which was a declaration issued by the Christian members of the newly formed International Council of Christians and Jews in Switzerland in 1947. So it's quite an early one. And I haven't got all of it here, but you can look it up online, actually. The text is online. It rejected any presentation and conception of the Christian message which would support anti-Semitism under whatever form. That's a huge change. You could say it's not enough, but it's a beginning. They're saying, okay, we do not want to teach Christianity in any way that could encourage anti-Semitism. Something has got to change here. They also urge Christians to remember that Jesus was born of a Jewish mother of the seed of David and the people of Israel. Again, something that very often and sometimes still is overlooked by Christians, that Jesus was Jewish. So they brought that up and enshrined that in the 10 points as well. The next year, 1948, when the World Council of Churches was founded in Amsterdam, they issued a declaration: we call upon all the churches we represent to denounce anti-Semitism, no matter what its origin, as absolutely irreconcilable with the profession and practice of the Christian faith. Anti-Semitism is a sin against God and man. So again, that's loud, clear, unambiguous message. The first move, and this one's not so well known, by the Catholic Church comes in 1958. Pope John the 23rd removed the phrase "the perfidious Jews" from the Catholic Good Friday liturgy. So that was actually taken out back in 1958. He also convened the Second Vatican Council, which ran from 1962 to 1965. And as you probably know, the Second Vatican Council was responsible for some of the most radical changes in Catholic Church in modern times. And one of its most radical acts was to issue the very famous Nostra Aetate Declaration in 1965, which really started, didn't finish, it started dialogue between the Jewish people and the Catholic Church. And there is a core bit that refers to Jews. Again, you can get the whole text up on the internet very easily. So even though the Jewish authorities and those who followed their lead pressed for the death of Christ, see John 19:6, and they're relying on the Gospel of John, always the most difficult one, neither all Jews indiscriminately at that time nor Jews today can be charged with the crimes committed during his passion. So I'll just interpret that. They say not all Jews back then were guilty of killing Jesus, and Jews today are not guilty of killing Jesus. That's big for the Catholic Church. Now, you might say it was pretty obvious, but it's pretty big for the Catholic Church in 1965. It is true that the church is the new people of God, yet the Jews should not be spoken of as rejected or accursed, as if this followed from Holy Scripture. Remembering then its common heritage with the Jews, and moved not by any political consideration, but solely by the religious motivation of Christian charity, it, the church, deplores all hatreds, persecutions, displays of anti-Semitism directed against the Jews at any time or from any source. Yeah, so that is a beginning document. It doesn't sound radical now. It was very radical in 1965. It was not universally welcomed in 1965 by Jews or by Catholics. The American Jewish Committee, which had been negotiating with the Catholic Church since it was founded in 1906, was a bit on the cautious side. And they said, the American Jewish Committee welcomes the promulgation by Pope Paul VI and the Vatican Council of the Declaration of Non-Christians as a turning point in 1900 years of Jewish Christian history and the climax to a historic effort to bring about a new era in relations between Catholics and Jews. A rejection of the charge of Jewish collective guilt for the crucifixion and repudiation of anti-Semitism are significant clarifications of church teachings that we hope will help purify the climate of relations between Christians and Jews throughout the world. So they said, okay, you have made a start. Good, thank you. We appreciate that. Many Jews were not impressed. There was no mention of the Holocaust. There was no admission of Christian involvement in violence against Jews for millennia, and there was no apology in Nostra Aetate. There was also no mention of the State of Israel. Okay, and this is 65. It's been around, you know, time to note this. And many Jews felt the document was too little and far too late. Others, still reeling from the Holocaust, didn't want any involvement in any interfaith attempts at reconciliation. And it's notable that in 1964, the very prominent American Orthodox rabbi, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, came out very strongly against any form of theological discussion or cooperation with other religions, presumably feeling the Catholic Church still harbored hopes of converting Jews, which wouldn't have been unreasonable at that stage. With the passage of time, however, the Catholic Church has put a lot of follow-up effort into improving upon Nostra Aetate, and they have done a series of publications and public gestures that have gained a lot of appreciation over Jews over the years. So, 1985, Notes on the Correct Way to Present the Jews and Judaism in Preaching and Catechesis in the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, this is parish education. This is how you teach about Jews at the parish level. That's really important. That means that parish priests can't say what they want anymore. They have to comply with this document. And this document does not allow them to say nasty things about Jews. 1986, Pope John Paul II revisits a synagogue. That was a very epic moment. The Pope had visited a synagogue. That was exciting. 1993, they issued something, the Interpretation of the Bible in the Church, which again dealt with anti-Semitic topics and also looked at the fact that, that the Church does not say Jews don't understand their own scriptures anymore. 1993, Vatican established diplomatic relations with Israel. My friend and the person who married me, actually, Rabbi David Rosen was involved in that and actually was made a papal knight sometime after that. 98, we remember a reflection on the Shoah. This is the first time the Catholic Church actually wrote about its involvement in the Holocaust. 1999, Memory and Reconciliation, the Church and the Faults of the Past, where they can't come to grips with Catholic persecution of Jews throughout history. The year 2000, Pope John Paul II visited Israel. I was there at the time. It was very exciting. 2002, the Jewish people and their sacred scriptures in the Christian Bible. So they are continuing. I mean, there's been more since then. Things are moving. It's a long-term commitment to a process of reconciliation. And later documents do apologize for the treatment of Jews over the centuries by the Catholic Church and also take responsibility for certain aspects of the environment that enabled the Holocaust. And most Jews have been on board with that and gone, good, you know, finally got round to it. The public gestures like the visits of popes to synagogues and the first one was in Rome, where the chief rabbi of Rome met the Pope. And there's some very moving pictures from that. And the recognition of Israel and the visit to Israel also did a lot to improve relations enormously. And you could sum it up by saying relations between Jews and Catholics are at an all-time high. And that process is going on as we speak. You might be involved with certain official Catholic things at a much lower level. But yes, you know, they are actively trying to make amends and to change things. And that it's going to take a long time to trickle down to every crevice of the Catholic Church, which is a huge institution, but they are making efforts at the highest levels. And things are changing, not the same as it was. What about the Protestants? Well, of course, there are thousands of Protestant churches, so it's not one process. And this is just very random selection. 1972, the United Methodist Church issued something called Bridges and Hope, Interreligious Dialogue Between Jews and Christians. They updated it in 1996. In 87, the United Church of Christ. These are all all these churches are putting out statements saying we don't think the Jews are horrible. We don't think the Jews are responsible for the killing of Jesus. We think that the Jews are good religious people and we want to talk to them. So they basically all say roughly the same thing, and they abjure anti-Semitism. They seek to improve relations. Again, you have the 1987 United Church of Christ says that God's covenant with the Jewish people has not been rescinded or abrogated by God, but remains in full force. Now, there's no supersessionism. They've abjured supersessionism. The same year, the Presbyterians in America explicitly renounced the idea that Christians have replaced Jews as the people of God. The Church of England has come out with God's unfailing word, which is along the same lines. And there are exceptions, it has to be admitted. A lot of these, as you can see, are pretty major major churches. These are large bodies. But there are some Protestant denominations, particularly the Southern Baptist Convention of the USA, that have not abandoned supersessionism at all. Some that's called replacement theology, and some of those are still going on with. exactly the way they did. Many of those churches have still stated that Jews can't be saved unless they convert to Christianity. Some of them do have active missionary groups that seek out Jews and try to convert them. There's Jews for Jesus, which is actually funded by evangelical churches. It has very few Jews in it, by the way. It's really a sort of a holding house for every Jew, and then you pass them on to an evangelical church. Eastern Christianity has engaged far less in interfaith dialogue. Some of the national Orthodox churches, like the Russian Orthodox churches, the church has come out with some pretty anti-Jewish statements in recent years, reviving things like the blood libel and the idea that Christian blood is used to make matzah. The leader of the Coptic Orthodox Church spoke out against dialogue with Jews in 2005, but that's probably much more to do with the Israel-Palestine conflict and the fact that the Copts are quite a vulnerable minority in Egypt. I was just in Egypt and stayed with Copts, and I can say they were very perfectly friendly to Jews. And last week I was at an interfaith seder with the Coptic Orthodox Archbishop of Britain, who was very glad to be there and issued an extremely nice statement afterwards saying how honoured he was and how Jews were brothers and what have you. So yeah, even there it's changing a little bit. Not all Orthodox Christians will hold anti-Jewish views, but still there's plenty of work to do there. And those and some of the more extreme evangelical type, not evangelical with a big E, but evangelical with a lowercase E, like the Southern Baptist Convention, some of those there's still work to do. But there's a huge amount of movement that actually has happened. And Jews have responded to these Christian initiatives. In 2000, a statement called Dabru Emet, Speak Truth, was issued. Places a full page ad in the New York Times, and it was signed by over 200 rabbis and intellectuals. And these were the basic themes. It's quite a long document, so I've squished it. Jews and Christians worship the same God. Jews and Christians seek authority from the same book. Christians can respect the claim of the Jews on the land of Israel. Jews and Christians together accept the moral principles of the Torah. Nazism is not a Christian phenomenon. The controversy between Jews and Christians will not be settled until God redeems the entire world, as promised in Scripture. No one should be pressed into believing another's belief. A new relationship between Jews and Christians will not weaken Jewish practice. And Jews and Christians must work together for justice and peace. And I put a few things for further reading there. So it's harder in a way to get Jews to make statements because, like the Protestants, we don't have the centralized hierarchy. It's once the Catholic Church decides it's going to say something, fine, as long as the Pope agrees, they just do it. And that's valid for the whole Catholic Church. Jews don't work like that. So there's no way of issuing a Judaism-wide statement. But there are many different attitudes, as you all know, within the Jewish community about interfaith dialogue and about reconciliation. And a lot of Jews are very involved in interfaith dialogue. I have to say, as somebody who is, I have not yet had a single missionizing approach. I don't think anyone I've engaged with would actually approve of that at all. I think they would be absolutely horrified by that idea. It's not to deny that many Jews are understandably very suspicious about Christian intentions and worried that there might be missionizing behind the dialogue. But okay, we've started the process. The process is moving on. Dabru Emet is a major start to it. Other statements have been issued by Jewish groups more recently. And you can't expect the appalling relations of several centuries to be undone in a few decades. It will take time. But we have turned a corner. I think that's really important. And I hope this course has helped a tiny bit by showing how Jewish and Christian history is very tangled, how we influence each other, how we learn from each other, how in the midst of our disagreements, there's still a relationship there. And thank heavens, maybe we have now got the time that that sort of relationship can become more productive and better. I certainly hope so. Okay, let's have a little look at if there are any questions. How much was Pope Nostra? Oh, do you mean Nostra Aetate? Every single priest would have had to read it. It would have been the focus of discussions in local parishes. It was a worldwide event. It was very, very well known. It was in all the newspapers. Anyone in interfaith, if you just say Nostra Aetate, they know what you're talking about. I would imagine most Catholics know about it because Catholics take the pronouncements of the Pope very, very seriously. And this was something authorized by the Pope at the very top levels. It was a papal statement. So there would be no excuse for not knowing and absolutely no excuse for not agreeing with it, by the way, either. So yes, it will have filtered down. What can you say about the Orthodox Church in relation to Judaism? Again, there isn't one Orthodox Church. There's the Armenian Orthodox and the Ukrainian Orthodox and the Russian Orthodox and the Greek Orthodox and the and various other ones. So they'll all be slightly different. I'm not as updated. As I said before, the Russian Orthodox Church has made some anti-Jewish statements recently. I can tell you that... Oh, no, he was an Ukrainian Catholic. No, we had an Ukrainian Catholic bishop at the Seder too, last week. I don't know the official positions of each one. Again, you'd have to look at them separately and find out how far they've gone. I certainly understood from the Coptic Archbishop, who was there last week, that things were going well as far as he is concerned. How many Orthodox rabbis signed the New York Times ad? Well, it was 200 signatories already. Altogether, you can actually find that and the signatories online. There definitely were Orthodox rabbis. I can't remember the numbers, but again, if you Google text of Dabru Emet, you'll find it with all the signatories and you can look. And, Haredi rabbis, I don't think there were Haredi rabbis on it. The Haredi world isn't, again, for understandable reasons, isn't very interfaith. I have once done some interfaith meetings with a charming Haredi gentleman in London. So I wouldn't say everyone is against it. And I can think of a major figure in London called Rabbi Herschel Gluck, who does vast amounts with the local Muslim community and Christian communities, is known to everybody. But A, he's unusual, and B, he's a gatekeeper. The Haredim don't talk to the modern Orthodox in London. Non-Jews, forget it. Though I gather in Stamford Hill, the Hasidic area, there's a very good working council between the local Muslim elders and the local rabbis about things like housing. They're very down together on practical issues that affect the community. But I'm sure they don't talk theology. I think that will all be, how can we get the council to do what we want? That sort of discussion. Or we're having a festival next Wednesday. Can you make sure you keep your hooligans under control, or various things like that? But I know they all get on very well. So I suppose that gives for practical interface relations, that does give some hope too. Yeah. Are there any other questions or questions about the whole course? I don't want to keep anyone too long because I see we're a bit over time. But given the fact this is the last one. Ben?
Okay. When the Catholic Church changes its doctrine to say the covenant with Jews never failed or still in effect and all that kind of stuff, is there an implicit or explicit recognition that previous generations sinned or were in error? And is that part of the issue about getting them to change things? That it's a tacit recognition that the past was incredibly flawed, their leadership and the like.
I'm sure it's an element in getting things written down out there. I think, again, you would have to look at the text of each. All these documents are available. You'd have to look at the text. There's probably a whole science of reading between the lines in all official statements from any church at all. I think they tend to gloss over we recognize we were in error in the earlier ones, but some of the later ones do contain apologies, which obviously recognizes they were in error. So no pope likes saying that a previous pope did something wrong, but they have actually got that far to say that, yes, the church has been guilty of treating the Jews badly. They have actually said that unambiguously. Again, there will be sectors of the Catholic Church where that has not gone down well at all, but it's the pope who matters. And if you disagree too much with the pope, you either get yourself excommunicated or you split off and form some weird splinter Catholic Catholics, anti-church. That has happened, by the way, not so much over Jews, but there have been some odd little split-offs here and there, most of which disappear after a few years. There are not very many of them that have staying power. So the Catholic Church, it's both an advantage and a disadvantage that's quite monolithic, because what the Pope says goes. So if the Pope actually can say, we have been in error, then it's incumbent upon all Catholics to fall in with that. Yeah. So things are changing. They have changed. And as I said, Nostra Aetate was the beginning, but certainly wasn't the end. And there's a lot going on in Catholic-Jewish relations at the moment. Huge amounts. Yeah. Any other questions? Oh, no. Look at that. Explained it all so well.
Yeah. Tremendous.
Okay, so I hope I'll see everyone in the future for another call at some point. And
absolutely, on behalf of everyone here, and on behalf of Torah in Motion, we're so grateful to have you. It's really just a pleasure. I don't really have the proper words of gratitude. I see some people, you know, silently showing gratitude in some of their boxes. Let's see if I can hold on, take the spotlight off so you can see everybody a little more clearly. Then I do that, find you. We can all, you can feel free also to unmute yourself if you'd like for a minute. You're getting a lot of hands up, and
thank you all so much. It's been lovely to
yeah.
Wonderful.
The whole series has been amazing. I mean, it's
thank you.
Incredible. Thank you.
Thank you. I learned so much. Thank you.
Yeah. And
thank you all,
you know,
for the fabulous questions, which have been really, really very good. I'm sorry if I couldn't answer all of them.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing to be able to gather together from all corners. And we should be blessed to be together in person sometime soon. And if not, we'll meet you back here at the same time for another course sometime soon. Please feel free to reach out to me with any questions. As I said, the Pesach series is starting this afternoon, so I hope there'll be something for everybody there. And a very early Chag Sameach, a Chodesh Tov to everyone, and good health.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye bye.
All the best.
Bye bye.